Hello, 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 Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM, Troy, New York, WOOS 98.9 FM, Schenectady, New York, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm your host, H. Bosch Jr., and filling in today for Olivia is...
I'm Amy Loria.
Ooh, listen to that voice. My goodness.
Today, we're looking forward to having Russ Haven of NYPIRG talking with Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Mark Dunley about the old problem of exposure of children to lead contamination.
Then I'll talk with Saranac Lake committee person Colleen O'Neill to talk about the Saranac Lake Winter Carnival.
Later on, roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry offers us the latest on the local labor movement with clips from last weekend's New York State Black and Puerto Rican Caucus.
Finally, we'll hear from Lisa Pepper Nodgerin. Her husband, Kanimo Nodgerin, has been detained in an ICE facility in Western New York for the last month. Now, the Cuomo administration. A top economic development official says the state isn't giving up on landing future Amazon projects, despite the internet's retailers' Valentine's Day breakup with New York. What a day to break up, right?
Classic.
Yeah, classic.
Classic. Man.
Valentine's Day. I wonder who took back the chocolates, right? Valentine's Day breakup in New York over local opposition to putting a second headquarters in Queens. Newsday reports Empire State Development CEO Howard Zeminski told the Manhattan meeting, the agency board of directors, that Governor Andrew Cuomo is not burning any bridges with Amazon. The head of the state's main economic development office says Amazon is a huge employer in New York, referring to the 5,000 jobs the company already has in the city. Zeminski comments come a week after Amazon pulled out of the deal that would have brought 25,000 jobs to Long Island City. Cuomo and New York Mayor Bill de Blasio, a fellow Democrat, had brokered the deal.
You think they got a bunch of crummy flowers and a hate mail Valentine?
Yeah. And somebody slept on the couch.
Yeah.
All right. For those of you tuning in, once again, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
And as Bosch just mentioned, to learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, no hate mail Valentines here, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. All right. Russ Haven of NYPIRG talks with Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Mark Dunley about the decades-old problem of exposure of children to lead contamination.
Wow.
We're talking with Russ Haven, who is the general counsel for NYPIRG, the New York Public Interest Research Group. One of the big issues that NYPIRG has been raising this year is the problem of childhood lead contamination, which kind of seems to have been with us forever, but apparently it's still a problem. So Russ, what is the problem, and you know, how prevalent is it in New York State?
You're right. This is a problem, a plague really, that's been around New York for decades now, probably half a century. A lot of people remember this as kids eating paint chips, and that was decades ago, and we thought we solve this problem and move beyond it. But the reality is in New York State, under federal guidelines, some 10,000 children are considered to be lead poisoned or have elevated levels of blood in their system. And that leads to profound consequences, including reduced cognitive ability, behavioral issues, serious health consequences, including reproductive problems, as they move on through their life. So this is a serious public health crisis. It's really at epidemic proportions.
I heard of some of the numbers in upstate cities, starting with Syracuse, are pretty incredible. Can you give us maybe a brief overview of what we're seeing?
some of the worst, most devastated areas in the country are in New York State, particularly because lead in paint was banned nationally in 1978, banned in New York City in 1960, and in New York State in 1970. It tends to be a problem in older housing, poorly maintained housing in older urban areas. And for New York State, the levels of children with high amounts of blood in their lead in their blood are off the charts. In Syracuse, somewhere around 40% of young children tested, Buffalo close to 20%, and Poughkeepsie about 15%. And again, these tend to be children of color, children who are of lower income in communities where the housing is mostly substandard.
So for most people listening to this, this issue has been around for their entire lives. This is not a new issue. Why is it still a problem after all these decades?
Well, the states failed to be aggressive, and instead of focusing on prevention, we're still mostly testing children and then dealing with it after the fact. So children effectively are the canaries in the coal mine. And it's not, while it's primarily low-income kids, should mention that this is a huge problem for people who are doing renovations. As old housing becomes more attractive and people want to update those old houses and they strip off old paint, invariably the lead dust, if safe work practices aren't used, everyone in the household will get exposed, and most vulnerable are the young kids who are crawling around on the floors, exploring their world, putting their hands into their mouths. That's when the kids are most likely to get exposed, and unfortunately that's coincident with the time when their brains are developing and are most vulnerable.
Now, I understand in some of the upstate communities, there's actually, you know, laws on the book that require the city to inspect for lead every time, you know, a new certificate of occupancy gets given. But the reality is that the cities don't actually train their staff. They don't have anybody on the staff qualified. They claim it's a budgetary problem. Is the governor proposing any funds to try to help remedy this situation?
The governor is proposing money to address lead poisoning, but there's no real mandate behind it in terms of mandatory inspections. The focus on the obligations of landlords, and mostly we're talking about rental properties, are not strong enough. And yeah, unfortunately, because this is not a situation where we can deal with a pollution source before it gets out, it's already in the buildings across New York State. It's very expensive, and it's a toxic metal, so it's not going anywhere unless it's completely removed, which is pretty costly, or you constantly maintain it. You can encapsulate it. That's like a 20-year fix, or you can completely remove it, which is more expensive. Or the more likely thing most people do is try and keep an eye on it, where you're constantly monitoring and making sure that the surfaces are intact. And so that means you need to be vigilant. And property owners are not so vigilant, particularly when they have a turnover of tenants.
Right. And I'm just going to take a wild guess, and many of these apartments are at the lower end of the economic scale. Some might sometimes call them more even some slum properties, but it's not particularly properties where the landlords are noted for superb maintenance.
Yeah, that would be spot on. That's unfortunately the picture.
So what are some of the other solutions that Nyberg has proposed to this problem?
Well, again, you know, there's limited things you can do to ameliorate the damage of lead exposure. So the key is what's called primary prevention, early intervention after that. And so we need to get in there and we need to inspect residential units, targeting our resources on communities with children who are lower income and in communities of color. We need to finally upgrade New York's regulation in this area to match the level of concern that the CDC, United States Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, established back in 2012. So it's shocking that New York is now 7 years behind the national standard for addressing lead poisoning of children. So we need to do that.
Now, I remember this actually came up a bit during the recent gubernatorial election, and I forget the number per, but it's like levels at 10, we wanted it to reduce to 5. I thought I'd heard something during the campaign that maybe it was de Blasio went out and lowered the limit, but apparently that's only applying to New York City and not to state and nationally. The problem tends to be worse upstate than in New York City.
Yeah, New York City's had a strong local law on the books that applies to rental properties with three or more units that aren't, basically owner-occupied. So most of the multifamily buildings in New York City are under a more stringent law. There's real problems with the administration of that law, but at least it's on the books. And so now, in many ways, although New York certainly needs to do a better job, the real problems tend to be upstate for children being exposed to lead from their housing. New York City finally moved forward, but they were years late to the dance as well. And now it's New York State that needs to get up to speed. Again, 7 years behind is disgraceful. There's just no other word for it.
So I guess a two-part question will end up. We've been talking with Russ Haven, General Counsel for the New York Public Research Group. People want more information, either what child-led contamination issue or NYPIRG in general, how do they do that? And if they happen to think this might be something that our state elected officials might want to do something about, what can they do at this point?
Yeah, please visit our website, NYPIRG.org, and there should be some information up on there. Please contact your state legislators, your assembly members, and your senators. It's budget time. The budget will get done somewhere around the end of March, and it's critically important that we upgrade the standards for protecting children from lead poisoning, that New York State overtake the program for certifying home improvement and abatement contractors, making sure they're well trained. We should follow the state of Maine and adopt a 25-cent per gallon surcharge on each gallon of paint that's sold, with that money being dedicated to lead poisoning prevention.
Thank you very much. This has been Mark Dunley for Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Okay, that was my good friend Mark Dunley and WOOC correspondent with Russ Haven of NYPIRG talking about the exposure of lead contamination to children.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy, WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady. In this week's Triple E's segment, our very own and highly distinguished H. Bosch Jr. sat down with Saranac Lake committee person Colleen O'Neill to talk about the Saranac Lake Winter Carnival, one of the best-kept secrets in the Adirondacks. The festival is a two-week-long celebration highlighting Saranac Lake.
Hello again, everyone. This is H. Bosch Jr. with the Triple E segment, Education, Empowerment, Entrepreneurship. Today's guest is Colleen O'Neill, volunteer of the Winter Carnival, Saranac Lake. Yeah, Winter Carnival. Publicity for the Saranac Lake Winter Carnival. Doing it since 2013. And she loves community and the tradition of this wonderful, wonderful event that's held every year that I like to think is the best kept secret in the Adirondacks. But after today, it won't. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'd like to say, I like that. It's the best kept secret in New York State, I think.
Right. Well, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for extending your hospitality to me and my crew. And we look forward to a great interview. You ready?
Yeah.
Okay. So what makes the Saranac Lake Winter Carnival parade different than other parades?
So there's a few things. I think you'll see acts in our parade that you would not see anywhere else, like really odd, quirky things. Like there's a whole dance troupe that dances literally with lawn chairs, like metal lawn chairs. So they use that as their choreography. And there's another dance troupe that uses canoe paddles for their choreography.
Wow.
There's costumes, there's musical bands, there's things that you just can't see anywhere else. Mm-hmm. And it's people come far and wide to come see our parade, not just locals.
Great. So how many people come out to the parade on an annual basis?
Easily over 10,000, between 10 and 20,000, I might estimate. It's one of our biggest events that we have during Carnival, and also our fireworks, but our parade, I'd say, is the biggest.
Okay, great. What's the Carnival all about? I heard I heard there's a lot of history behind it. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so we've been doing this since 1897, actually. It's our 122nd year this year. Mm-hmm. And we haven't been building the Ice Palace consecutively since then, but it's been sporadic throughout the years and throughout history, depending on what was going on that year. It could have been time of war where they didn't have the carnival, or financial hardship would be another reason why we wouldn't have it. But we have it every year now, consecutively, since the 50s. So it's been going strong.
This has been going on since the 50s.
Consecutively every year, yeah. Before that, since 1897, sporadically.
So isn't that something?
It's been going on a very long
time.
Like
I said, this, down our way, this is the best kept secret. This is the first time, and I was telling my crew, I actually had a timeshare years ago in Lake Placid and never heard of it. Wow.
Yeah, I mean, we're all volunteers, and we're nonprofit, so we don't
tell that to them too. They're volunteers, nonprofit.
Those are the best kind of events, you know, where people are doing it because they love it. Mm-hmm. So when we do make profit, it goes right into next year to being able to put this all on again. Like, the parade is a huge cost. The fireworks are a huge cost. And we're only able to do this because of our sponsors and because of volunteers that help us pull the events off, because of items that we sell at our headquarters, which is just down the street from the Ice Palace, that proceeds we get from that go right into next year to do the carnival again.
So what kind of events, I think you talked a little bit about it, but what kind of events happen during the entire carnival and specifically today? Because I understand we got something that's pretty interesting.
Yeah. So today and tomorrow are kind of our big last weekend. We have two weekends. Today, the big event is our parade, and then we have some other sporting events going on. There's tons of live music tonight, and then tomorrow there's more events than I can even list. There's snowshoe softball, there's snow rugby happening today, there's a woodsman's exhibition happening today where they throw axes at wooden targets.
That seems really exciting.
It's all over the place. It's all different kinds of events. It's typical or traditional winter sporting events. It could be events that you've never heard of before. We pride ourselves on having a good mixture of events that, if you're not into winter sports, you can just spectate at. For example, the Woodsman's Exhibition is something good to spectate at.
Okay.
The parade, everybody loves. That's a no-brainer.
Okay.
Tomorrow, we have a big closing fireworks.
That's what I was going to ask you. Tell me more about the fireworks show. Here is, I think you said tomorrow night.
So that closes out the carnival on February 10th, and it's at 8 p.m., and it pretty much is a huge fireworks show. I always get people telling us that it's the best fireworks show they've ever seen.
Really?
It's typically a very long fireworks show, too, so it's a good way to you've had fun for the last, we've had the carnival for the last 10 days at that point, and it's a good way to kind of end it on a on a really dramatic note, and you know, everybody likes fireworks. So.
So how long is the carnival? It starts when and goes for?
So every year, it's typically, it usually falls on the first, right near the first of February, or the first weekend in February. Like next year, it'll be starting January 31st.
Okay.
And it'll go 10 days. So we always have a 10-day carnival. And right now we're on the ninth day, so tomorrow's our last day.
And weather doesn't affect it? I'm sure you guys are used to dealing with weather.
Normally we have such cold weather here that it doesn't affect it. There are some years like this year where we've had unseasonably warm temperatures, and unfortunately it did affect our ice palace where we had to repair it because the slush that holds the ice palace together started melting. So stuff like that, we have to step in and see if we can salvage things. Some of our events that required snow got canceled because we had a warm down, but then it iced back up again. So the hills were too icy to do skiing, for example, or tubing. So it's been a roller coaster this carnival. Usually it's a bit more smooth where we have very consistent cold temperatures here in the mountains. So
tell me this then.
Yeah.
What goes into building that ice castle?
So it's a lot of volunteer work.
It almost looks like it could be one of the wonders of the world.
Yeah. It's pretty amazing. We start by sawing ice blocks out of our lake, and then we guide them up, and then a machine picks them up and brings them over to where they're assembling the ice palace, and they do it block by block based on a design that they create. And it, on average, takes about 2 weeks.
I was getting ready to ask.
Yeah.
About 2 weeks.
There's been times.
And daytime, that's the only time they work on it?
Yeah, usually from like 9 to 3 every day, they'll be out there every single day for 2 weeks. There's a core group of people that are there every day, all day long, but we also get people from the community that want to help. Average people that just show up and help too. So we also invite people from outside the area that, if they want to be involved
right
and help, so next year
here.
Make sure to, usually about 2 weeks before the carnival, you can count on us. As long as the weather's good, we're starting to build it.
Okay, so how much does it cost to get in, and what are the hours?
So the great thing is that the Ice Palace is open 24/7 and it's free.
Wow.
And it's lit up at night.
That is awesome.
Yeah, I mean, we could do it to make money to put into carnival, but we don't do it. We do it because it's our community tradition. We all love it. And, you know, we're sharing it with people. We're not requiring you to pay to see it. And we just want you to enjoy it. And, you know, we invite people from outside the community to see what we've done, too.
I would think, and I'll ask you, do you get a lot of Canadians that come in?
We do, yeah. Because we're not far from the border.
Right. Exactly how far from?
About 2 hours from Montreal, if you're talking about the city. But in some places, you can be an hour from the Canadian border.
Wow.
Depending on where you come in from. But, yeah, it's... Canadians, we get a lot of people from downstate New York and New Jersey and Connecticut. We even got people as far away as Alaska some years and Germany. And, you know, it's kind of a mix of people tend to find out about it on social media a lot from far away.
Right.
And they come. We had one lady from Arizona. So, it's kind of an oddity for a lot of people because this kind of deep winter is hard to find. And consistently where you could have something like an ice palace and have it for like a month or more.
So will the ice palace stay open and lit up at night after the carnival is over?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So as long as...
Or do you guys just let it melt away?
That's a good question.
Like the snow in my backyard.
No, so as long as we can keep it up, we do. It all depends on weather. And we post updates on our website, which is SaranacLakeWinterCarnival.com. And also on our Facebook page if something changes. But it'll stay open as long as weather allows it to be safe. If we get another warm-up, it's very fragile. So we try not to keep it up if it's looking like it could be in danger of melting or, you know. So we basically play by ear based on the weather. And we'll let everybody know when it is closing, but if you don't see an update on our website or our Facebook, assume it's open and people can come in and walk around and come at night and see it lit up.
Okay.
And, you know, even our carnival events, although they're ending, those are free. Most of those are free as well. So if you want to just come up to spectate at them or participate in them on our schedule, you'll see if there's a dollar sign next to it. But most... All of our events are free.
Now, I understand you're a Jersey girl.
Yeah.
How did you wind up? Did you zig when you should have zagged? You know, and no accent.
Yeah.
No accent. Wow.
So I've always loved nature, and I actually didn't know that the Adirondacks existed. Mm-hmm. And once I found out about it, I came up here in the summer for kayaking and then camping. And then in the winter, I would come up and I would hike in the mountains. So I just started really realizing all the recreational opportunities here. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I just felt like these were my people. They appreciated nature in the way that I did. And
No smog flowing over
no
from
traffic,
Manhattan.
No traffic.
Yeah.
People are very
you can get
nice
anywhere you
other.
Want within a half hour.
Yep.
You know, in Jersey, a half hour may mean 3 to 5 miles during traffic.
Yeah. And it's, you know, the good thing is that we don't have a lot here in terms of, like, comparing it to New Jersey, where there's all kinds of stores and everything mm-hmm. within, like, right on top of each other. But here, things are more spread out. But I find I like things simpler. I like things quieter. I'd rather have to drive an hour away to get to stores that I used to drive 5 minutes away. So mm-hmm. I'd rather have this surrounding me, nature, than stores.
Okay, so before I close out, where can everyone find more information about the carnival and the Ice Palace?
Yeah, okay. So there's tons of information about the Ice Palace on our website, which is saranac-lake-winter-carnival.com. Mm-hmm. You can find out the history, how it's made. You can find out what kind of events we have. You can find out next year's date and see the pictures from this year's carnival. Mm-hmm. And then our Facebook page is updated quite frequently.
Okay.
So that's also a good place to go. We also have a Twitter page and a Instagram page. But mm-hmm. Facebook is the main place where we update things a lot.
And I understand next year you will be having an act. What's his name? Boy Who Spills Jam on His Pants. On his way to
donuts.
The yeah, strawberry donuts.
Maybe
on his pants.
Maybe that could be a carnival costume. Next
yeah,
year.
Yeah. We're gonna include that into the act. Yeah, boy who spills strawberry jam on his way to the carnival and has to hide it. You know.
Well, you'll see this year. If you know when you're out and about, you see a lot of people dressed as dinosaurs.
Okay.
Year. So that's our theme is prehistoric park.
Great.
So if you see a lot of people out there dressed like dinosaurs, that's why.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for giving us the opportunity to come to this awesome event and inviting us to your town.
Well,
we appreciate
you.
That.
Yeah,
yes.
We're glad to have you and all your viewers and your listeners. Mm-hmm. Please, if you can't make it this year, come
right.
next year.
Yeah,
January
and we're going to post on our page and our website, and I'm going to spread you like the gospel. Down
great.
There. Yeah.
We appreciate it. We want everybody to come join and have fun with us.
Great. Okay.
Yeah.
So let me close out. Until next time, folks, it's about the triple E's: education, empowerment, entrepreneurship. And remember this. Don't hear about making a difference. You need to be about making a difference. This is Inez Bosch's baby boy, H. Bosch Jr., doing what I'm made to believe. All right. What a great, great interview with an extremely, extremely kind and successful human being. That was my segment, Triple E, speaking with Saranac Lake's committee person, Colleen O'Neill, about the Saranac Lake Winter Carnival Festival.
Great job on that one. That was real. It's a real fun one. Sounds
Thank
like you.
You
guys had a great time on that trip.
Yes.
For those just tuning in, I'm Amy.
And I'm H. Bosch Jr. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or a sour bone to pick, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region. The Hudson Mohawk Magazine Network's roaming labor correspondent, Willie Terry, attended the New York State Association of Black and Puerto Rican Legislators Caucus weekend at the Empire State Plaza on Saturday, February 16th. In this segment, you will hear comments from Thomas P. DiNapoli, State Comptroller, Terry Melvin, New York State AFL-CIO, Marcos Crespo, a State Assemblyman, Henry Garrido, Executive Director, AFSCME DC 37, and Carl E. Heastie discussing politics and the labor movement.
This is Willie Terry, your Roman correspondent from the Hudson Mohawk Network. And I'm here at the Black and Hispanic Legislative Caucus weekend and be attending several of the events. It's about 8 o'clock in the morning, and I'm here at an event that's sponsored by New York State Comptroller. I'm going in and seeing what's happening. They're having a breakfast, and I think the controller is at the mic. And I'll try to get some of his comments.
About important issues, and at this breakfast, we recognize some great New Yorkers. And boy, do we need unity and resilience now more than ever, don't we? Don't we? We're going to show the leadership here in New York. You think of all the legendary New Yorkers who've made an incredible impact, our great heroes from our history who've been associated with New York, Harriet Tubman, Frederick Douglass, A. Philip Randolph, Shirley Chisholm, so many others. But the reality is we have heroes and heroines in our midst that are making history and making a difference today. A role model, an example for what we need to lead us to better days in the United States of America. We know in some ways we feel we're going backwards with what's happening with this administration, not only with policies, but with the rhetoric, with the divisions. We seem to have more instances of hate, discrimination, anti-Semitism, bigotry. I mean, you go down the long list. We are going through a tough and challenging time. And that's why we must rededicate our efforts for New York to be, as the governor always says, the progressive capital of the United States. And aren't we all committed to that vision and that goal and that effort?
That was the New York State Comptroller, Thomas DiNapoli. Yeah, moved on to a labor luncheon, and next you will hear some of the views of the labor leaders that spoke there. First up is Terry Melvin, who's Secretary of Treasury to the New York State AFL-CIO, and also President of the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists. And also you will hear from Assembly Marcus Crispo, and also you will hear from the person who gave the keynote address at this luncheon. His name is Henry Garrido. He's the executive director of AXME DC 37, which is located in New York City.
We got failing public education system because folks got stealing money from our system. That's a national emergency. We got occupant of the White House that took this tax thing and did reverse Robin Hood on us, stole from us and gave to the rich. That's a national emergency. And in New York, we ain't trying to build no damn walls. We trying to build bridges because we're all in this game together. We can achieve a new standard, set a new benchmark, and break old norms as long as we work together. As long as we keep our commitments to our people, as long as we plan for the future and not just for today. It is our time for New York to retake the mantle as the state that cares most about its residents. That is leading the charge in progressive legislation that will make voting easier, that will organize more workers and never go right to work. New York will be the beacon state that will show the rest of the country how to resist incompetent, racist politicians. We gather here to celebrate our electoral victories and commemorate our collaboration between our politicians and union members. We're here to remember that this is more work ahead of us. I'd like you to give it up right now for Assemblyman Marcos Crespo. Give him a hand.
Thank you, Reverend. Buenos dias. For those some of you who have heard me talk about my story, my dad was an undocumented immigrant from Peru. Mommy was born in Puerto Rico, couldn't finish her studies, she had us too young. But my father came to this country and met a guy, Frank Tirabosco, a proud DC-9 painter. Frank mentored my father, showed him a skill, helped him get into the union, and it was because of the opportunities that organized labor created, what DC-9 did for him, that I was able to have an opportunity at success. And so I stand here humbly to say that if it wasn't for the work of so many of you in this room, there wouldn't be Marcos Crespo standing in these opportunities in halls of power. And I got elected at the age of 28. I wasn't somebody who grew up in a political household. I had a union father. I had a mother who believed that I could do more, who understood politics when I didn't. And they said, you know what, try something new. And here I stand. And why is that relevant to what's happening across the country? We have to get back to basics, ladies and gentlemen. We gotta get back to organizing in a way that involves everyone in our communities. And if you're not a member of a union, you have to be a part of the movement because you will benefit from the work that is being accomplished. We have to fight for economic justice, criminal justice reform. We have to fight for our homes, our communities to not be disbanded and people forced out. We have to fight for economic opportunity that empowers everyone, not just the CEOs, but the workers. We have to make sure that where public dollars are invested, that it's not charity given to rich folks, but rather that it is charitable back to the people who sweat the success of those businesses and those developments. We have work to do up here in Albany. And you should know that the Assembly has been a staunch supporter of the labor movement, and we have seen a sea of change in the state Senate. So we have an opportunity to finally get some things done that have been stagnated for too long. And we will work on those issues. But understand, and I'll leave you with this in terms of just opening remarks, the fact of the matter is that politics goes hand in hand with policy. And you have to understand that we have colleagues, Democrats, who believe in our issues, but have to protect their political viability. And that is important because now more than ever, we have to be able to go into those neighborhoods and tell those people and educate those somewhat Democrats that they can't fall into the rhetoric of oppression and hatred and division that the president is selling. This isn't you against me. This is all of us together as New Yorkers. We have to start educating the people in our communities to realize the role they play in these fights. And there are too many of my colleagues who are afraid of taking the positions they know are right because of what it can mean politically. I encourage them to stand strong. I encourage them to understand that when you do the right things will happen in your life. Some of us believe that in faith, others believe it by practice. But the fact of the matter is, all of us can help by organizing, mobilizing, and doing what unions do best. Educating and empowering families. And going into those districts and lending that hand and that support to make sure that members can stand strong on the votes they'll have to take. And with that, let's get this...
Sisters and brothers, we are blessed today to have a great labor leader that's going to come before us to give us our keynote address for today. This individual is a native of the Dominican Republic. He happens to be the first Latino to lead District Council 37 as its executive director. In his tenure, before even becoming executive director, he established the Municipal Employees Housing Program. He has, since becoming executive director, put together a union strong program, which is improving services, enhancing communication, one-on-one conversations with his members. He is a strong advocate for his members, all workers, and our community. Most of all, I want to say that he is a servant leader. He is out there with the people, working with the people, lifting up the needs of the people. And the best of all, for me, he is not just a brother in unionism, but he is my brother, he is my friend, he is always on the battlefield. I give you the executive director of AFSCME District Council 37, Henry Garrido.
I also want to say something before you put me on the stage, which is, I do think Harry's right. President Trump is right, there is a national emergency. He is the national emergency. He is the national emergency. And I'm very proud of the work that labor has done. I'm very proud of the midterm elections. I'm very proud to continue to push for empowering the women who have led the way in this argument from the beginning of the marches, but also at the political spectrum. I am extremely proud of the work that the union has done in that movement. But let me be clear, brothers and sisters. I love Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez. She is a my representative, I live in a district, I support her, I voted for her, and I am extremely proud of the work that she's done. And I will continue to push for her. But before there was an Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez, there was a Lillian Roberts who was willing to sacrifice and be put in jail so that healthcare was there for people. And we need to recognize the work of labor and the role of labor has played. And I'm going to leave that for my conclusion of my remarks. We have a lot of friends here in the state legislature. And we heard from our friend, Assemblyman Crespo. But sometimes those friends tend to forget who put them in the play, in their position in the first place. Sometimes they need to forget, they tend to forget that labor has not only taken the sacrifice in tough times, so when it's time to enjoy the majority, labor should be protected in that process. And I don't care where you are on the side of the Amazon fight, whether you were for it or against it, no one should be disputing the right of workers to have a union in the workplace, that the employees in the workplace to have the ability to fight for themselves, for health insurance, or pensions. And that's what we saw. So brothers and sisters, let us bow our head, bless this food, and go about our business. Thank you very much.
That he didn't want to be judged as the first black speaker of this institution. He wanted to be judged as the best speaker, period. And I think he's doing a fine job to accomplish that. Ladies and gentlemen, please help me welcome real progressive leader, our speaker, Carl Hastings.
Good afternoon, brothers and sisters. First, let me, knowing my history and knowing that I was a union member before I was elected to the assembly, and the position that I had before becoming speaker was being the labor chair. And that just shows the relationship that I have with labor. Labor has always been best friends with the assembly. The assembly's always been best friends with labor. And I'm so happy now that we have a Democratic Senate. So all of the progressive things that have been held up, all of the things that all of you out here pushed for and wanted, but we still have a lot more to do this session. We still have to deal with rent regulations, right? Rent regulations, right? New York City is becoming too unaffordable for our brothers and sisters. So let me just be brief, but I just want to say to all of you, the commitment from the assembly, we'll try to figure out how to make a dollar out of 15 cents for all of you here in labor, because we know how important it is. The labor has protected and it's ensured that there's a middle class in this state, and we never want to see that undone.
Thank you, my good friend, Mr. Willie Terry, our roaming labor correspondent, with his segment, Labor Voices, reporting from the February 16th New York State Black and Puerto Rican Caucus.
Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Elizabeth Press is back with another immigration segment. Kanimo Nagoran came to the United States from the Ivory Coast. He left in 2004 during a period of civil unrest. On January 23rd, he went to his ICE check-in and was detained and moved to a federal facility in Batavia, New York, the next day. For the last 10 years, Kanimo has worked as a cook for the Capital City Rescue Mission. Perry Jones, the executive director of the mission, is also his sponsor. Elizabeth Press spoke with Kanimo's wife, Lisa Pepper Nagoran.
Lisa, thank you so much for joining me here today on WOOC 105.3 FM.
Thank you for having me.
Can you tell us a little bit about what happened with your husband, Kanimo Nagoran?
That day, we went our ways. I knew he had an appointment with his attorney, Fred Korkos, and ICE. When I was out of class, I hadn't heard from him, and I knew because of the appointment that I needed to get in touch with him. So I called around until I finally called the mission, and one of the gentlemen who works within the kitchen is the one who told me that he did not come out. So went into panic mode, wondering what to do, and I remember Kanimo telling me where the office was in Latham. So I went there, and I got there about 10 minutes before they closed at 4 o'clock. I was able to get in and speak with someone who informed me that he would be moved shortly to Albany County Jail and then was going to Batavia.
Kanimo is your husband. You're married, but can you explain how His status remains.
When I met Kanemo, it was the end, towards the end of 2013. And he had, and this is where the terminology is, it's not a work visa, I don't think. It was work authorization. But I know that he was sponsored by Perry Jones. And he had gone through checking in with ICE, you know, routinely. And you know, he can work. When I met him, he wasn't undocumented. You know, he's always had that work, that ability to work, his ID and all of those records through DMV. You know, once we got married, October of 2016, that's when we filed for the spousal record. And then it's now been approved as of a week ago, this past Thursday. It all happened, you know, in less than 48 hours.
You travel out to Batavia, New York mm-hmm. every weekend since this has happened.
Yes.
And yes. That's 3 hours?
It's about four.
4 hours.
It's about four. And being February, you have storms in between that make it a bit more than that it can be. So it's the travel itself. I'll go wherever, mm-hmm. you know, whatever. But the fact that he has been placed on the other side of New York, and not forgetting that it was an elective that ICE did place him there. He didn't have to be, and he still does not have to be in custody, we'll say, because he does have the ability to work with a sponsor. And we now, you know, thankful to this process, the one good thing that may have come out of it is the fact that we now have the spousal visa that has been approved. So that is a giant step forward on that front, because we've been waiting for it for so long. But the fact, it's difficult, from finding a place to the weather to just the time, you know, and the time away. But it's the only way that I can see him, so I'll do it. But knowing that he could be here and we could be going through the process with the attorneys to file, also ease of access to attorneys to have discussions, because only one attorney is out in Buffalo, Nicole. You know, she's able to practice in the Western District. That's where they were at the hearing. It makes it difficult for communication, because we're talking about people that are down in New York City that are helping, as well as who are professors themselves, you know, between Sarah Rogerson, and there's no one spot where they're coming from. You know, they collaborate via email and phone and conferences, and then they have to just make sure all the paperwork is done.
February 25th is the next. Yes. Is the next hearing.
Yes.
And so, so just recap for me real mm-hmm. quickly. So he was detained on January 23rd. He went out to mm-hmm. Batavia the next day, and then there was been a series of hearings. Through one of them, mm-hmm. He got a stay,
temporary restraining order. Yes. After the Friday of the press conference, afterwards, the two federal attorneys came back in and told me that the temporary restraining order that was announced, that they had filed it that Friday of the press conference, that it had been approved, but it was only through Monday. So they had the attorneys then had Friday evening and the weekend to prepare for the hearing on Monday. And then from there, it was postponed until the 25th, because they are now discussing subject matter jurisdiction to determine if the decision can be made in the district court.
If it's the right place to make the decision.
Right.
You have U.S. Representative Paul Tonko. You have Albany County Sheriff Craig Apple. You have Albany Mayor Kathy Sheehan. There's numerous probably other people that I haven't listed. There's Free Kanemo petition going around mm-hmm. with some 2,000 mm-hmm. signatures on it. There's a lot of support from both elected people and the community for you and your family.
It's amazing that there is the support, because from Kanemo working at the mission, and Paul Tonko has been there because they do Super Bowl, you know, every year. But from the first time that Kanemo and Paul Tonko met one another, Paul Tonko asked Kanemo to show him what he does. And from there, they've been a team for a meeting and serving every year. But that, along with Kanemo's been in the community for a long time. You know, he lived across the street from the mission above a shop where he would shovel all the way around up to where the police parking lot is. So he's seen in the community, known in the community from people coming through, and also people who volunteer. There's all manner of people from all over that volunteer. And because Kanemo was the weekend cook for, you know, every weekend for years, that's who people would see. And he would close on the other days when he was working, which was, I think he had Tuesday, Thursday off. So there was a lot of people coming through there. Any dinner service all weekends. You have students from a variety of colleges who are just offering their time to churches that are coming in, to Paul Tonko, to, you have the whole spectrum of people coming. And Kanemo, he is the same. People get the same respect from him, but it's a genuine respect. It's not lip service, because Kanemo has an ability where he's not excitable. He is not a wallflower. He's quiet, but he's watching. He's very communal. And I found that from his family. I say his family because they're from a variety of places within Africa. But he found Teresa, his American mom, because she recognized a mark on the side of his face. She started speaking to him in his dialect that is from the area within the Ivory Coast that that mark is from. And from there, that's actually how his case was able to progress, because she's from the Ivory Coast. She's here. Her family is there. So they were able to actually send money, do all the legwork and processing in order to get the paperwork that was necessary for him to have some things to provide for his check-ins with ICE. So it's meeting that group and how they're very inclusive. He has a lot of friends and keeps those around him very close, and he shows them respect, but it's genuine care for them. And I think all the people, circling back around, I think all the people that are supporting him are because they have experience that, and he's had over a decade to develop relationships with people, and he's definitely done a good job. It is genuine support because they know him, not just as a cook at the mission. You know, they know one another because coworkers have become friends. People in the community have become neighbors, not just in passing. And there's a lot of connectivity.
How is Kanemo doing now? It's been a couple weeks now that he's been detained.
I ask him how he is, and I'm glad that he's not sad. You know, I think this would be much harder on me. I think it would be much harder on him if either one of us wasn't able to know the other one seems to be okay. That does a lot. And being able to talk with him is amazing. It's not easy to be able to talk with him, believe it or not, in just paying for different things, finding the right place to pay, to have him have the funds. So there's hoops that you jump through. So not only is he across the state, but he could be here. He doesn't have to be there. So once you get past that, and he's okay. He is not angry. I remember him saying after the first hearing, when I spoke with him and I told him, you know, that it's been extended, they're going to discuss, you know, whether it can be determined in court. So there's a hearing on the 25th, but he probably won't be there. So again, I want to communicate everything. So I will definitely be at any hearing so that he knows what is happening on his behalf, that he isn't able to be there to hear.
So then there's also the barrier of, like, when you do meet him, you're across from, there's plexiglass between you.
Yes. The last time I saw him before going to Batavia was when he was in Albany County Jail, which was small tables with just maybe a 6-inch plexiglass that you just can't, you don't reach over. So I was not prepared for walking into a concrete closet with a phone that you can talk to while you look through glass. That was disheartening because I didn't realize it was, when they say detention facility, it's a detention facility. You know, there are people there through from immigration, but they also have crimes against them. So there are different levels. So it's everyone gets treated with the maximum level of security for that. It's just, I think where he is in his group, he's, you know, they're not mixed. He is in just with a group of about 60 men who are there just for immigration. No criminal, you know, issues mixed in with that outside of immigration. But as far as how he's doing, he arrived late Thursday and talked to me on Friday in the evening. When he spoke with me, he said that he'd already been approached by an officer who said that he looked strong because Kanemo loves to work out. So he's doing what he can. There's stairs, there's walking, there's some things, pull-up bars. He will find whatever it is. An officer came and said that he had a job for him. He says, you know, the pay is nothing, basically, but it's something to do. So Kanemo has been very happy to do that. There's a gentleman who saw him working out who he now has a workout partner. He is creating a community there, which is the same as I've witnessed him do here. He will say, being here is not easy, but he's making the best of it. And he said, we're together and we will fight together and he will be patient. We, you know, are firm believers in God. And he references that. He says he has a prayer corner, does set time away for it while building the relationships that I think help him, because it's a connection. It's a family where, you know, you don't pick this family, but they're creating connections for one another. I think it's good. From the things that I hear, they are able to share one another's joys. And I don't know.
So what now? We're quickly running out of time. What does our audience need to know?
What happened is what you would think of as a worst case scenario, barring him being deported already, which seems to have been possible. I just didn't know how close he may have come to that before the temporary restraining order was issued. So leaving for the day and thinking that, why can't I get a hold of him? And then to actually have the words said, they kept him. It's just flashing of what goes by. And what I could think of is Kenemo is there, has no idea what's happening out here, how I'm finding out. He couldn't get a hold of me. I can't get a hold of him, obviously, now. And everything that happened after that happened so quickly in those first few days. You hold your breath and thinking of how many other people have gone through this and are going through this, whether they're in the news and if they have the backup that Kenemo has had of people coming and stepping up for this, I'm thankful that there is that connection within the community of both the mission, having been within the community, working with people who they have that mutual respect, where they have come forward and in support for Kenemo, but not just for Kenemo, but for this type of thing that's happening, because there do seem to be things that could have been handled differently. Each case is not the same. So I'm thankful that if there is reform, if there's some option for that, that means that other people don't have to go through this separation where it almost seems like it was an option for them to do when they chose to do it. But it's also an option that they could choose not to do it, or they could do it in a different way. You know, it's being felt by me and also the mission, because they have somebody who was an integral part of the kitchen, and it's a lot for all of them to step up and handle. But if it draws people out, and if there's a community that can come together, and some of the things are on the Free Kenemo website and those that have chosen to post that, and there's a connectivity where people are posting among there, if it can link people to help, I think just even understanding and trying to navigate the process, if that can be found from the website and the links of it, I'm happy for that. I'm not thankful for how it's come about, but I hope people are able to be helped in this.
Okay. That was Lisa Pepper Nagorian, interviewed by Elizabeth Press. The next hearing will take place in Rochester, New York on Monday, February 25th. For more information on Kenemo Najarian's visit, Facebook page Steve Kenemo. The family also set up a GoFundMe at GoFundMe.com/SaveKenemo. That concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm your host, H. Bosch Jr.
And I'm Amy Loria. Our engineer tonight is Felix. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose on demand through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. If you have comments, suggestions, or a tender confession, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
And actually featuring Susan B. next coming up. All right. As a reminder, Hudson Mohawk Radio Network is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering with our radio effort, shoot us an email at mediasanctuary.org, or just stop by one of our weekly meetings on Monday nights here at 7:07 p.m., held right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Till next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.